One time I saw a ghost on top of my barn. I was alarmed. He was on my barn. I climbed right up and said, "Ghost, trick or treat." And I scared that ghost right out of his sheet. That's what Halloween is. It's a frightening time. Welcome to the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Episode 63 now in your ear just before Halloween is being released. And if you are, maybe you're doing your final preparations here for the holiday, or maybe not. Maybe it's not your thing, and that's totally cool. Or perhaps you're even listening to us after the holiday is over. Maybe you got the Halloween hangover, your belly distended full of candy, and maybe the makeup isn't completely washed off your face, and maybe that costume has to get back to the rental place. Who knows? Hope you had a good holiday. If you did, if you are about to get your holiday on, hope you enjoy it. If it's not your thing, as I said, that's totally cool as well. I'll stop babbling and get right into it. Episode 63, as I said, is here. But before we get there, a couple announcements from the Sundress Academy for the Arts at Sundress Publications and this program. The days are coming close here as the Sundress Reading Series November installment is coming to you in Knoxville, Tennessee at Bar Marley. We always like to bring these up to you, and the latest one, as I said, the November installment, November 6th at 2 p.m. at Bar Marley in Knoxville, Tennessee. You gotta hear this lineup, okay, of who's gonna be reading this time, because it is a devastating lineup. We've got Tiana Clark, Anthony Frame, and former SAFTAcast guest Dan Shapiro is going to be there as well. It is going to be, that's a trio right there. That is a hell of a trio right there. And I encourage you, if you are anywhere near the Knoxville area on November 6th, from 2 to 4 p.m., stop by Bar Marley. Admission is free, and you get to see some awesome writers read some awesome, awesome work. Hey, speaking of awesome reading, awesome writing, just as a reminder, if you're listening to us before Halloween, then you are aware that the SAFTAcast has a contest going on. The Write a Little, Read a Lot contest. Anytime during the month of October, if you write a review of the podcast on iTunes, you enter to win two Sundress titles, Theater of Parts by Mixmack and At Whatever Front by Episode 62 guest Les K. Full details can be found on our website if you visit saftacast.com. You'll see it right in the center of the menu bar. Now, I'm going to just dispense with the rest of the news and jump right into the episode, because that's what I know you're here for. Episode 63 is with us with Lauren Eggert Crow. Truly awesome to get to talk to her out in Los Angeles, and as you will soon hear, she has a lot to say about All Hallows Eve, including some of the best costumes she has ever worn, some of the best decoration jobs she's ever done to her home, and what is so awesome about Los Angeles, and what makes for a really good book review. That's coming at you in just a moment. As always, we enjoy having you with us here on the program as listeners, and we thank you for your support as we continue forward. Now, shut up, Scott C., and get right into the theme song. It's going pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I've actually never done a podcast interview before.
Oh, well, I'm glad that this one maybe is one to start out with.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Because, you know, a little relaxed, no pressure, no. You know. We always say on the show, it's kind of like just people getting to know each other, you know.
Like a first date or a job interview.
So what do you think you can bring to this company, Lauren?
Well, I can bake really good baked goods. I can bring those to the company. That is my most valuable asset, is my baking skills.
And where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I don't know. Probably pushed out of Los Angeles by rising rent prices.
I see. And do you consider yourself a people person?
Definitely, yeah. But I'm also a cat person, so, you know, kind of 50-50. I don't know.
Just out of curiosity, what's the weirdest thing you've ever been asked on a job interview?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know if I've actually gotten a lot of weird questions. I don't really have an interesting answer to that. I think all of my questions have just been pretty standard. It's like, what can you bring to the company? Like that kind of thing.
I asked that because I was on a job interview once, and I'm not kidding. The guy ended the interview by saying, one last question. What animal do you consider yourself most connected to?
Was this a tech job?
It was in healthcare.
Okay. Because I feel like a lot of those questions, like, you know, imagine yourself as, you know, you're 1 centimeter tall and you're trapped inside of a blender. How do you get out? Like, that's actually a question that I've seen as an interview question. I was never asked it. I feel like those are all things in, like, the kind of hip, cutting edge, like, quote unquote, creative technology sector because they want to seem really edgy and cool. What did you say for your answer?
Penguin.
That's good. Why a penguin?
Because they're at once very formal, very proper, because they're wearing the tuxedo look and everything, and they're rocking it. But they're also like the clowns of ice. They're so ridiculous at times. They're hilarious.
That's cool. Did you see March of the Penguins?
I did.
So good. Yeah.
Quite enjoyable.
This will henceforth be a podcast of very old references. We'll just talk about things that happened in the 2000s.
Oh, I thought you were going to say old references. I'll go right into, like, you know, let's talk about Kate Smith and her performances on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, wow. I can't help you there. I'm undercultured and uneducated when it comes to the Ed Sullivan Show. So does all of this go in the podcast or do you edit it? Because I feel like I'm not really at the top of my game right now. I feel like, you know, I'm trying to, like, spinning my wheels, like, warming up a little bit.
Yeah, keep it all in there for the most part.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Normally on the show, and we've kind of already broken into that ground, I'd like to start the show usually with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. Trademark.
Hey.
So here is our burning question that is currently on everyone's mind. What is or has been your best, maybe most favorite Halloween costume you've ever worn?
Oh, thank you so much for asking me that, because I could probably talk about this for the entire episode. I have had so many good Halloween costumes, and it's hard to pick what my favorite is. I will say that one that really sticks out is Halloween 2008, when I was living in Santa Cruz. My boyfriend and I, at the time, did a couple's costume at the Santa Cruz Halloween Parade. It was my idea that I had for, I swear to God, at least 3 years. We went as the Owl and the Pussycat. Do you remember that old nursery rhyme? It's like a golden book. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea green boat. There's a pig with a ring at the end of his nose. He married.
I think I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
It's a good poem. My parents used to read it to me when I was a child. So I wanted to be the owl and the pussycat. So we did a gender switching thing. I was the owl. I wore sort of like a tuxedo and an owl mask. And I found a green guitar at a flea market. And my boyfriend was the pussycat. He wore a red polka dot dress and cat ears. That was an easy costume. But the best part of it was we made a pea green boat out of a radio flyer wagon and paper mache.
Okay, that's adorable.
It was the best. It was so great. And we covered it in chicken wire and then paper mache'd it and painted it green. And we even somehow made a sail. Like, I think we stuck like a dowel rod in the middle of the boat and then hung a white sheet from it for a sail. It was pretty awesome.
Do you have plans for this year?
Yes, I do. I'm actually going dancing tonight, and my costume this year is sexy kale.
As in the vegetable?
In the vegetable. So I guess it was a couple of years ago, there was this trend of people wearing quote-unquote sexy costumes to be ironic. Like, costumes that were not necessarily sexy. You know, not like your sexy nurse, sexy librarian, sexy vampire, but just crazy things like sexy table, sexy pizza, just as a way of, you know, sort of being ironic about the whole sexy costumes trend. So I said I just wanted to be something really silly and dress as sexy kale. So I got a green skirt and a green tank top and green taffeta fabric that I cut into giant kale leaves. And a yellow ribbon that I'm tying around my waist, like a twist tie that says organic kale on it. And I'm wearing fishnet stockings, you know, to bring the sexiness. So that will be the marker that it's a sexy kale costume. And I think I'm going to put actual kale leaves in my hair, like a bridal crown.
That is absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
My hat, uncostumed hat right now is off to you on that one.
Well, you know, I really love Halloween. It's one of my favorite times of year, and I still feel like every year I say, okay, next year my costume's going to be better. And one of these days, I would like to make an incredible costume, like pull out all the stops, you know, work on it for months. But I usually don't start planning until a few weeks ahead. So I often do DIY stuff, but sometimes it's a little bit thrown together. I also find myself sort of torn between the silly, funny, maybe topical parts of Halloween and the more beautiful, ancient, spiritual, mysterious side of Halloween, like for my pagan side. So I'm always kind of torn between, do I want to be like a kind of mysterious witch this year, or do I want to be, you know, sexy Kale? So this year, sexy Kale won out.
Have you ever had a costume just completely, you know, just go completely south on you and just tank and just not work?
I feel like, well, let's see, there was one time in fifth grade where I, for some reason, even though when I was a kid, I was really into Halloween and always planned my costumes, and my mom often made costumes for me, which were really awesome, but that year I didn't really have an idea, and so, like, at the last minute, I just went as the Phantom of the Opera, which I actually was kind of disappointed in myself for, and I felt like it was kind of lame. Even though I was obsessed with that musical back then, I don't know, I just felt like, I could do better with this.
Maybe now you're trying to kind of exercise that demon a little bit, that failure.
Yeah, you know. But I've had some good ones in the past. One year in 10th grade, I was a futuristic angel because I had seen The Fifth Element and I just wanted to do everything like The Fifth Element. And I bought fairy wings and I got a battery pack of Christmas lights and I, like, taped them to the wings and so my wings would glow.
Techno angel.
Yeah, the techno angel. It was very 90s.
Which The Fifth Element certainly was.
Yes, definitely.
Not dumping on it. It's a good film overall.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen it since 1998, so I can't really remember a lot about it.
Oh, that's awesome. So the Halloween thing goes back then deep into childhood for you, then.
Oh, yeah. We always had pretty amazing costumes growing up. We often had family costumes, which was really cool, that my mom would make. Like, one year we were Alice in Wonderland. My mom was the Queen of Hearts, and my dad was the Mad Hatter, and I was Alice. Another year, we were the Wizard of Oz. My dad, like, wore a cardboard box that he spray-painted silver, and he spray-painted his face silver, and he stuck a funnel on his head, and he was the Tin Man. Another year, we were a family of mermaids, and my dad was a sailor, so my mom made us all of the girls in the family, she made us these little mermaid costumes out of stretchy patterned lycra and little tutus and sequins. It was pretty cool. We've, like, had some pretty cool Halloween costumes in my family.
That's adorable.
Thanks.
It's good to hear that the spirit isn't dying. Sometimes I feel like it is.
Well, I think it's reviving too, just because the internet is making it so easy to share pictures, and so people want to share pictures of their amazing costume ideas, and there's Pinterest and Tumblr and Instagram, and even if you don't have anything to do on Halloween, you can still, like, show the internet what your costume is.
Yeah, I wonder if cosplaying has also helped.
Oh, yeah, I would say definitely it has. I haven't really done any cosplaying. I don't have enough creativity as far as, well, I have creativity, but I'm not really that crafty in making costumes that spectacular, but it looks pretty cool.
If you could do cosplay, you know, who would you do?
Oh, man. I think I'd want to do some kind of mythical figure, because there's not a lot of sci-fi. Well, okay, there's some sci-fi that I like, but none of them are really that interesting of costumes. Like, I really like Buffy, but that's not really that exciting of a cosplay costume. I don't know. Maybe, like, some kind of Greek goddess or something. Like, just make my hair really crazy and get face paint and, like, really amazing dress, and I don't know, something cool like that.
Ooh, maybe next year. Greece revival.
That could be cool.
Like, what if the gods and all that were around now?
Yeah, that could be interesting.
USB ports on them.
Yeah. The god of Instagram.
Oh, you could be Deus Ex Machina, the god in the machine and the god of
That's
the machine.
Cool. I do like the idea of dressing as concepts. One year, when I was a senior in college, I dressed up as Deconstructive Theory.
Okay. Okay, how does that work?
So, well, Jacques Derrida had just died, so it was kind of like an homage to him. It was very conceptual. Like, I got a skirt that I glued puzzle pieces to, and then I had a t-shirt that I did an iron-on transfer of that had, like, a magnifying glass over a bunch of different jargon that has to do with deconstructive theory, and I wore a beret, and on the back of the shirt, it said, "We miss you, Jacques Derrida." It was very, very nerdy, but I won first place in my English department's Halloween costume contest.
In your face, other contestants.
Exactly.
Okay, now I can kind of conceive it now, because you say a costume dedicated to deconstruction. I'm like, how does that work exactly?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of, sometimes I just get this idea in my head, and I'm like, yes, this is what I have to do this year. And so that year, it was like deconstructive theory.
Moving away from costumes for a second, do you also deck out your house or your pad with Halloween paraphernalia at this time of year?
Well, I have in the past. I didn't really do much this year. I kind of go back and forth because sometimes I like to be completely kitschy and just put up all of the fake spider webs and the spiders and, like, you know, like pumpkins from Walgreens, like all that kind of stuff. And then sometimes that just feels tacky for me and I'm not really called to it. But I feel like my best Halloween house decoration stories come from when I was living in Santa Cruz, actually. This is another story about me and my ex. We decked out our house one year to look like an underwater sea, like a haunted underwater seascape. We got all this stuff at the thrift store. We had, like, blue sheets and shower curtains that had fish on them. We found a scuba diver, or like a scuba suit, and we put that in the yard with a scuba mask, and we created this weird kind of sea monster out of paper mache, a sheet that we spray painted green, and then we, you know those like foam mattress pads that the undersides kind of look like egg cartons?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we cut those into tentacle-looking things, and we spray-painted them green, and then we, like, wrapped them around the scuba diver scarecrow that we had made to make it look like he was being strangled by the sea monster. And then the porch, we made up, like, a pirate's treasure chest with, like, treasure chest and candles and skulls and, you know, jack-o'-lanterns, and we tried to make it, like, a very haunted underwater kind of thing. It was cool. The trick-or-treaters seemed to like it. So sometimes we do stuff like that, but it's been a while.
That is totally awesome.
It was pretty fun. It was a pretty cool one last hurrah Halloween decoration.
Makes me feel ashamed that all I have is a pumpkin.
You know, that's okay. I haven't carved any pumpkins this year, and I'm not sure I'm going to have time to before Halloween, so it's kind of like Christmas. You can't get too stressed out about the things that you want to do, or otherwise you will not feel the spirit of the holiday.
Breaks my heart. Down here where I live in South Florida, there's a decided lack of Halloween around here.
Yeah, I just read, I don't know which part of Florida she lives in, but T.A. Noonan's piece on celebrating Samhain in Florida and how it's really difficult because it's like hot and muggy and not exactly the sort of Celtic, beautiful fairyland that you think of when you think of kind of old Halloween celebrations. So I can imagine that, you know.
Yeah. Hard. It's never too early to start on next year's costume, I don't think. So.
That's true. I should think about what I want. Well, it does feel like last Halloween was just yesterday. Like, in some ways, this year. Actually, it's funny. I was just thinking about this. In some ways, it feels like this year has flown by. And then in other ways, I was thinking about Bowie, and I was like, it was only this year that he died? Because in other ways, this year feels like it's just stretched out and has been so long. So time is weird like that. I spend a lot of time thinking about time and the elastic, taffy-like nature of it. It's just interesting. Like, yesterday I was thinking, wow, I can't believe 2014 was just one year after 2013. Do you ever feel like that?
I do. Thinking about it in terms of TV shows. Today, watching a show, and I'm always curious about how TVs and movies portray time.
Yeah,
and
like Breaking Bad is interesting that way.
Yeah, I was watching a series finale of House and thinking about like how it messes with time and location. So
How to Get Away with Murder does that too, although it's gotten so hard to follow.
I've actually never watched it. I think it's in my Netflix queue, though.
The first season is really good. You should definitely at least watch that.
But then there's so much in my Netflix queue, isn't it?
I know. I feel buried under the things that I want to watch and read and do. We just have so many options.
I know, and yet we're the most bored generation of all time.
Really? Are we? Is there data on that?
I don't know. It's something a friend of mine theorized in high school, was that we're the most entertained generation of all time, yet the most bored.
Here we are now. Entertain us.
Exactly.
No, that's not our generation.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like trying to describe a generation, all you can really do is rely on anecdotal evidence, which is shaky, but my idea of millennials, well, at least I don't know if you're a millennial. I am. Is that, like, we're not bored? I don't know. We have a lot. We definitely have a lot of entertainment options and a lot of stimulus options. Maybe that makes us a little bit prone to make, like, it's difficult for us to kind of sit in stillness and sit with ourselves and not be busy and looking at our phones all the time. But I feel like that might just be a human condition thing than a generational marker. I do notice just the sort of feeling of wanting to look at your phone when you don't have anything else to do. But I had that feeling even before I had a cell phone. I just didn't have a cell phone to look at. So I feel like it's just something that humans are, I don't know, predisposed to doing, is we kind of need constant stimulus and things to look at and things to distract ourselves with.
I never thought about that, but I think you may be onto something there. Remembering back before cell phones and going, sitting in a waiting room, yeah, you would look at everything and read the same magazine 5 times.
Yeah, we always need distractions. I mean, I feel like the draw towards meditation would not be as strong if the desire for us to be distracted and kind of frazzled and frenzied in our mind all the time were not just a permanent part of human life.
But there's been so much, I hate the fact that there's been over the, getting back to generations real quick, there's been a lot of stuff in the think pieces in the last year basically shitting on millennials.
Yeah, and then there's also plenty of articles, too, that are defending millennials. So that's good, at least.
I understand where the shitting comes from. I'm from Gen X, technically tail end of Gen X.
All right.
And I understand because every older generation has to shit on the new one. But I'm one of the people that counters it going, you know, I'm a teacher. I see my students. They're kicking ass.
Yeah. And honestly, I feel like most of the pieces about how horrible millennials are focusing on 22 to 27 year olds. But who among us did not have any insufferable qualities when we were between the ages of 22 and 27? Look at any generation, and everyone in that period of their lives is going to be screwing up, trying to figure things out. You know, not all, like your hip, like your, what's the word for it? Your neofrontal cortex is not developed yet before 25. And so we're still making bad decisions when we're just out of college. And that's not because we're millennials, it's because we're still growing. But I also really believe in young people and what young people are doing and the ways they try to change the world and the way they try to shake up the status quo that was handed down from the generation before them. I feel like I'm really speaking in cliches right now, but you get what I'm saying.
Cliches are sometimes the best way to say something, to say what you mean and mean what you say.
Right.
Quoting an old song there. But anyway, getting away from all that, you mentioned earlier that, you know, let's go back a ways here with it. You know, we like to get to know our authors, our guests here. So going back a ways, you were raised in Pennsylvania, right?
I was, yes. Southeastern Pennsylvania.
So near Philly or in Philly?
Yeah, I grew up in Chester County, which is like on the border of Amish country.
Okay. Near Lancaster then?
Lancaster. I'm going to Pennsylvania explain to you. I was probably a couple hours east of Lancaster.
Was it just you, and your parents, or do you have siblings?
I'm the oldest of 3 children. I have a younger sister and a younger brother. They're both totally awesome. And my parents are totally awesome, too.
So that makes the family costumes even more intense, then, to have 5.
Yeah, we definitely had some cool ones.
So were you in the suburbs, then, or
yeah,
more
so,
rural?
Well, up until I was 11, we lived in a small kind of suburb slash like industrial sort of bedroom community of Philadelphia, right on 422, which is a highway that goes into Philadelphia. And then we moved into sort of more rural suburbs of Chester County. So we grew up in a development that was really secluded in the woods, surrounded by fields on the top of a hill. And growing up, I didn't think it was rural. I just thought it was, that's what every place was like. But then having lived in cities and coming back, it's like, oh yeah, it's actually kind of rural, but also very suburban and close enough to Philadelphia that there's still a lot of activity and there's still culture. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of farmland and fields and woods. And I think the Future Farmers of America club at my high school was gigantic. So that gives you an idea of sort of what it was like where I grew up.
Do you get back there often?
Yeah, a couple times a year.
Family's still there?
Yes, everyone's still there.
So it's a good homecoming then.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I always have a good time when I go home. My family's still really close, so it's nice.
How'd you come to wind up in California?
Oh man, it's like a long story. I went to grad school in the University of Arizona. And then I moved to Santa Cruz, California after that to follow a relationship. And then that ended. And then I just moved to LA because I felt like it, basically. I wanted to get out of a college town. I had been living in college towns for a while. And I wanted to live in a city, in a big metropolis. And I'd kind of always been fascinated by Los Angeles. So I figured I would try it.
What was intriguing? What was fascinating? Or what fascinated
Every
you?
time I visited it, I was just struck by how large and sprawling it was. I felt like no matter where you went, you could never know all of it. It just seemed constantly unfolding and full of all these strange little pockets of beauty and weirdness. And I would visit my friends in Echo Park and Silver Lake and just be completely enchanted by the secret staircases there. I'd go to Griffith Park and find that, just captivating and lovely. I just felt like Los Angeles was this place where I could be completely consumed and lost, and had thought about moving to San Francisco, but San Francisco, as beautiful as it was, didn't inspire that kind of feeling in me. And Los Angeles did, just because there's so much here and it's so jumbled up and juxtaposed and bizarre. There's all these, like, even just walking around the city, there's multiple different kinds of architecture just juxtaposed next to each other. And a lot of people hate that because it's not uniform or cohesive, but I kind of dig it.
It's interesting you mentioned that because that's been an allure of LA for me for a while, was since hearing about that on another podcast, talking about like how you'll have classic Spanish architecture and then suddenly you'll walk a block and then there's this whole modern and then ultra modern all mashed into one.
Yeah, it's just, you'll never know what you're gonna find. Like walking around some of the Hollywood Hills neighborhoods, there's these weird kind of Germanic castles right next to places that have Roman columns, right next to Craftsman's and old Spanish, kind of Spanish style, mission style mansions. It's weird. It's really weird.
Does that extend beyond the architecture into the people of LA? Because I know LA has a reputation for La La Land.
Yeah, and I think that reputation doesn't hold because the truth is, Los Angeles is a major city, and most of the people that live here are just regular people doing jobs that are working and have lived here for a long time, maybe for generations or their whole life. And this idea that Los Angeles is just, nothing but plastic surgery, starlets, really vapid, kind of uninformed, uneducated people is just really not true. There's a lot of very vibrant communities here, and there's vibrant history and culture, and there's diversity, and it's actually the city has a lot of heart.
So it sounds like to me like when you go to LA, if you live there, you don't even need to really take vacations from LA. You just kind of have a staycation because there's always something more.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of need vacations from LA and just that I need to get out of a city. But I think I would need that if I lived in any city, just kind of go to the mountains or the desert or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to do here. I'm often overwhelmed by how many things there are to do. But I mostly just live a pretty normal life. I go to work, I come home, I try to see my friends. I do a lot of literary events, and I often keep busy that way. My calendar is often really full of my friends' book launches and reading series. But, I think there's this idea that people who live in LA are just, constantly on vacation or just living this sort of dreamy Hollywood life. But most of us are just kind of scraping by or living a pretty normal life.
Just doing the normal business of survival.
Yeah, like not everything is glamorous. There's all these streets that are really iconic in Los Angeles, like Rodeo Drive and all the places in Beverly Hills or Sunset Boulevard or Santa Monica Boulevard, and they're just part of my commute to work. Like I drive down them listening to podcasts. It's, not everything has this sort of glorious movie soundtrack behind you as you cruise through the streets.
Most of the people in those shops are just doing a job.
Yeah, exactly. We all are.
Okay, for our listeners who have never been to LA, and I like to ask this of a lot of our guests, if I were to visit LA, what is maybe one or two places I should definitely hit? Don't even worry about likes or dislikes.
Okay. I'm really East Side prejudiced because I live on that side of town. So I'd be taking everyone to basically hardly anything west of the 405, even though that's where the ocean is. So I would definitely say Griffith Observatory and Griffith Park. Pretty much everything in Griffith Park is really cool, but the observatory is really amazing and it's free to get into, which is awesome. I like the museums I like are LACMA, MoCA downtown. The Museum of Jurassic Technology in Culver City is really strange. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like sort of a fake art history, natural history museum. Walking through it feels like walking through a very strange dream. So that's a really cool thing. I would say go to the beach because it's the beach. I feel like everything I say is just, it's very cliche at this point, but the Venice canals are amazing. The beach walk in Venice is, a cool thing to see. There's a million good restaurants that I take people to. I really like just wandering around Echo Park and Silver Lake and Los Feliz, all of those hills, all of those secret staircases. Elysian Park is really awesome. The Last Bookstore, which is one of the coolest bookstores I've ever been to. It's downtown. It's in an old bank building, and there's columns, and there's this labyrinth of books. You have no idea how much I am moving my hands right now as I'm talking. I'm like trying to illustrate this bookstore in the air.
For our listeners at home,
Yes, just picture me constantly flapping my arms as I talk.
now you're making me regret that I did not get out to AWP in
Yeah,
LA.
it was incredible. You should have come. Have you been to AWPs before?
Oh yeah, last one was Minnesota for
Oh,
me.
cool.
Couldn't make it out last year, the standard reasons, money, time, etc.
I didn't go to Minnesota for that reason either, but this was the first year that AWP was in my city, and it was just amazing. It was the best. I was so happy that whole weekend.
I kind of regret it because I've never been really west of the Mississippi, like too far west. I think the farthest I've been is Arkansas. Been most of the East Coast, but I've been everywhere on the East Coast, every state, every major place. But I just have never gone. It was like I really thought I could get out there but didn't happen this time. But in the future, it will.
You gotta make it out to California. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
It's such an amazing state to me because it's like three entirely different biomes in one state.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about it is it has the desert, it has the redwoods, it has the ocean, it has these really amazing cities. Every part of it is so diverse and so unique.
So at this point, do you feel like you're a native of California?
No, I'm a native of Pennsylvania because that's where I grew up, but I do really love living here.
Can't picture anywhere else at this point.
Who knows? Life is long. I don't know a lot of people that have not moved somewhere else. I'm only 33, so who knows where I'm gonna be in 15 years or 20.
Given the option, though, you'd prefer to stay.
Maybe.
I can totally understand that. California is a mysterious, but it sounds so wonderful. And now you're really making me want to go to L.A., so.
You gotta come out here.
And there will be a number of writers who will probably be very happy if I make it out there.
Yeah. We have a great literary scene here. I love L.A.'s writing community.
What's so great about it?
Well, my theory is that because we are not the main industry, it kind of frees up what maybe otherwise would be, like, kind of a lot of jealousy or tensions. Like, everyone's just really lovely to each other. Like, we're all supportive and encouraging. There's just seems to be this very warm vibe of people collaborating and really cheering each other on. AWP Los Angeles was just a really great reminder of that, of how many writers here I feel very lucky to know.
So it's not like New York, where basically it's dog-eat-dog, kill each other in Mortal Kombat.
Well, see, I don't even know if New York is actually like that. I don't really know the New York writing scene very well. But I do feel like maybe it's because we're not the film industry. We are kind of a little mellower. But then again, a lot of literary writers that I know are also part of the film industry. So maybe I'm just bullshitting. But in any case, I really like the LA writing community. And I feel very happy to be a part of it.
It's got a chill vibe. That's always good.
Yeah, but also a driven vibe, too. People are always making and creating and pushing forward. We have some really innovative projects going on here.
Are you at liberty to divulge any
of them? Yeah, sure. So I would say everything that Writ Large Press is doing is really spectacular. They have, so like a couple years ago, they did this amazing series in the summer called 90 for 90, where they did 90 literary events in 90 days, which was just, it was awesome. There's a lot of women's writers groups. There's a million different reading series that are going on. There's several different small presses. Really, I feel like Los Angeles is just a treasure trove of literary goodness.
So it's got a chill but driven vibe to it of, like, people are doing it and they're doing it on purpose, but there's something about it that makes it a little bit different than other places.
I think so. I mean, I haven't really experienced the literary communities in other places, so it's hard for me to judge. I mean, this is the only major city that I've lived in, so I can say that I like this writing scene better than Santa Cruz's, but I didn't really find much of one in Santa Cruz, and it's possible I just wasn't looking in the right places there. And also, Santa Cruz was a college town, so... But I feel like there is something special about LA, and it's probably because of the convergence of histories and cultures here. There's a lot of what I really like about LA is this sort of fusing of literary pursuits and social justice activism, working on literature and also working on feminism and anti-racism and anti-classism and trying to bring all those worlds together. It really redefines the idea of community. I feel like the people that I look up to in the LA writing community are constantly thinking about what community means and how to continue shaping that idea and making it a community for everyone.
So, in other words, a very progressive scene?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, now, this is a caveat that there are non-progressive people here, and I feel like lately there's always some stupid racist bullshit that happens, but yes, like, even though there are those problems, which I think are everywhere, you have the problems of racism and sexism and people who just don't really understand what's going on, you also have really great leaders who are working to change that.
There's so many scandals right now, so to speak.
Scandal is the wrong word for it.
It is.
There's, like, last year leading up to AWP, I felt like there was something that happened every week. And it's still happening. I mean, you know, a white writer will say something asinine and racist and offensive and then not apologize for it until they're forced to. And it just keeps happening. And so, yes, that definitely drags down the idea of the writing community and people's experience of it. But there are also people who are not like that and who are working to counter that.
We're trying to build communities.
Yeah, I'm trying to build communities that are inclusive, that are just, that are, that address systematic injustices. So that gives me hope.
Does me as well, you know, because I see it as well. Every week, something's dropped. And I'm not dismissing any of them because, you know, charges are valid. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's that we're more observant, or maybe we have more access to it to see it happen.
I don't think anything is happening more frequently. I think we just see it more because of social media. I think it's probably not correct to think that any kind of example of racism or misogyny or xenophobia, we know none of that is new, but we are seeing it more because we have access to this, the, you know, sort of democratization of media through the internet, through social media.
And there's more people standing up and going, bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, people have been standing up and saying bullshit forever, but maybe, like, it's a little bit easier to see them now just because of the internet.
I say fight the good fight, please. We need more ass-kickers out there.
Oh, we all try. You know.
Call it out when you see it and attack it as needed. You know, that's my advice to young writers.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. Go after them, man. All right, so I'm going to return to Halloween for a moment.
Okay.
The hours are ticking down now before the holiday hits and everything. And, of course, right now, people, we're talking about Netflix earlier, are, like, frantically searching through Netflix, Amazon, whatever services they have. What would be some Halloween movie recommendations for you?
Oh, man.
From you.
Well, there's a couple episodes. All of the Halloween episodes of Buffy, obviously. Season 2, season 4, and season 6. There's actually a bunch of Buffy episodes that are good for Halloween. I tend to like Halloween movies that are a little more nostalgic. So Hocus Pocus, like, which is actually not that great of a movie, but it's fun. And then some of the old Val Lewton movies from, I think they were in, like, the 30s or 40s. I Walked with a Zombie, Cat People, Night of the Demon, The Seventh Victim. Those are all some really cool, like, black and white, old sort of moody horror films. All of the Hitchcock movies, too, like Vertigo, Psycho, Rear Window, those are all some good, like, not that they're Halloween themed, but, you know, some, I generally tend to prefer my scary movies more kind of moody and spooky and beautifully shot than gory and horrific. I'm not a huge fan of horror movies.
But you prefer the suspense and tension horror.
Yeah. Like, you know, I actually watched the Blair Witch Project for the first time 5 years ago, and I was like, this is actually, it's a scary movie. That I can handle, but any of the sort of more famous Halloween movies that are just really terrifying or really gory never have really interested me.
So those are really good recommendations then, is basically saying get out of what people would expect you to watch. Get, you know, expand your mind a little bit with this.
Yeah, I would say I'm better at recommending Halloween books, though. I have a lot of those. I usually do, like, a big recommendation list every year. So everyone needs to read Bruja by Wendy C. Ortiz, which is forthcoming on October 31st this year. I also recommend At Night by Lisa Ciccarello, Salt is for Curing by Sonia Vatomsky, and Scarecrone by Melissa Broder. Those are three excellent poetry books for Halloween. Also, The Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter is a really good book of short stories for Halloween. It's like spooky retellings of fairy tales. And Angela Carter is just a goddess. Also, Cruddy by Linda Barry, even though it has nothing to do with Halloween, it is a scary, strange, macabre, beautiful book that will fuck you up.
Now, I'm going to have to write these down after the show here and make note of them.
Definitely. Oh, also, anything by Kelly Link. And as a Floridian, I'm sure you have read her.
The name has come up multiple times.
She's great. Her book, Pretty Monsters, is one of my favorites for Halloween. It's an excellent book of short stories. She is just a fantastic fiction writer. Also, anything by Helen Oyeyemi, White is for Witching, is a really good one to read around Halloween.
Definitely some interesting. I'm definitely going to have to check some of these out and, you know, at least find the synopses online and then obtain them.
Yeah.
When did you, I know that, you know, reviews are kind of one of your big things. How did you get started in doing reviews?
Kind of accidentally. I just moved to Los Angeles and I was just looking, I was trying to be a freelance writer and I just sort of fell into writing book reviews. I ended up writing a few reviews for the Los Angeles Review of Books when they were still just getting their start and when they were still on Tumblr. And then because of that, I was able to build up a portfolio of clips that I could then get other book review writing assignments from. So it just kind of happened. I mean, I've always really loved literature and I like writing about literature and talking about it. So it just seemed like the best path for me for doing freelance work. As it turns out, you can't really make a lot of money being a freelance writer, especially a freelance book reviewer. So that is not my full-time job. But I do them every now and then, and I always like it. I've written some that I'm really proud of.
What are the biggest challenges as being a reviewer? Because I don't know if we've had many reviewers on this program. We've had a couple, but what do you see as like the biggest challenges when doing reviews?
I think for me, and I've actually, as a reviews editor, I've noticed this with some other people that I've asked, that I've assigned reviews to. If you are an English major, if you sort of learn to write by writing term papers and thesis statements on books, it can be hard to switch your brain to writing an actual review of a book where you have this sort of anxiety to create some sort of unified theory about the book, like a thesis statement that you're going to prove with quotes and other literary analysis. And it actually is a lot more of a relief when you realize, oh, I just sort of need to talk about how this book is structured. What is it about? Where does it succeed? Where does it not succeed? What are the characters like? What is the language like? How is it, what is the tone? Like, what do you think the author was trying to do? But that can be a challenge if you are used to, if you want to try to find, okay, like, what is this book really about? What is this really fascinating theory that I can come up with that no one else in class has thought of yet? And there are definitely a lot of book reviews that are written like that, that whenever I read them, I'm like, oh, why didn't I think of that?
As a reviewer and editor of reviews, what makes for a really good review? Not like, you know, good as like, I praise this book, you know, but like, what makes for a quality review?
I think what makes a good review is when it's obvious that the writer has spent a lot of time thinking about the book, reading it from different angles, and bringing in other cultural artifacts, other references, other theories maybe, or other kinds of literature to really show that this piece of literature is part of a larger whole. I really like reviews where it's just very obvious that the reviewer is really smart and has really put a lot of time and thought into what made the book tick.
So it's not just about, say, you know, who can write the wittiest or most cute or flippant lines.
Yeah, I'm not really that. You wouldn't know from talking to me, but I'm not necessarily that big a fan of the witty and flippant, at least when it comes to writing. I was like that for a while, and I probably still have a lot of those habits, but I feel like that sort of brand of internet writing has gotten really old with me, just in my own opinion. I tend to like stuff that's a little meatier.
It feels like in the age of vlogs and video reviews and such that, unless you're really bringing something new and unique voice to the table when it comes to that, it just comes off as annoying.
Yeah, like everyone's trying to imitate everyone else's voice, which is definitely what I have done in a lot of my articles. You know, you want to write like a clickbait headline and then kind of put on this sort of cutesy, flippant, smart aleck kind of voice where you assume you have an audience that's laughing at how witty you are. And when I realized that that's not the kind of writer I was, I felt this huge sense of relief, just realizing, oh, I am not a cultural journalist who has to write, you know, quick on the draw, hot take think pieces the day after something happens. And then when I realized that, I could just go back to writing poetry and maybe essays that take me 2 years to write, then it just felt a lot better.
Always good to find your strength.
Yeah.
Relax, you know, stop putting the pressure on yourself kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's really exciting when something goes viral, but then it's forgotten about, so...
No, I've actually never had anything of mine go viral, and I consider that kind of a blessing.
Yeah, it's the higher you climb, the farther you have to fall. So when you go viral, when you suddenly have all of those eyes on you, that's where trouble can really happen.
I prefer it if it's just like viral among, say, 30 people right now.
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
Like, you know, when I get 80 likes on Facebook, like, that's a viral day.
Yeah, I can feel it. It's like, hey, I post something and like 15, 20 people engage on it. Yeah, like, hey, that's a great day for me.
Yeah.
Gas. It's all good. And yeah, well, we could get into the whole thing of internet marketing, but we'll be here for a while. Before we wrap this up in all capacities and you can get into sexy Kale outfit and go rock a dance floor, before we let you go, though, let's, you know, just talk for a second here. Obviously, you've got a couple of awesome chapbooks out there through Hyacinth Girl and through Sundress, and I've had the chance to, you know, peruse them in my library, and whoa, my, you know, brain blown away.
Wow, thank you.
Awesome stuff, and I encourage our listeners to check them out. But what's going on right now? What have you got coming out in the near future? Anything coming out recent, coming down the pike pretty soon?
So my chapbook from Sundress is still forthcoming, so that will happen at some point in the next year. I also have a poem that won second place in Black Warrior Review's poetry contest, so that'll also come out next year. I have one poem that will be in Ghost Proposal magazine in December, which is an online journal. I think that's all I have right now. So I clearly need to start writing more and submitting more.
But definitely some hot stuff coming out then.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the chapbook. I'm not quite sure what the timeline is, but I'm definitely very psyched about it.
Well, we will definitely be looking for it as it comes out. And where can the folks find you online, Lauren? They want to know a little bit more about you, maybe check out your stuff,
yeah,
that sort of stuff.
So you can go to laureneggertcrow.com, which has all of my published writing is archived or linked there. There's also links to my Facebook and Goodreads and Instagram and Twitter there as well. Also, I am extremely Googleable in that if you Google Lauren Eggercrow, I am all you are going to get. So you can also do that as well. Also, people should check out Women Who Submit, which is an organization that I'm on the leadership team for. It's an organization that encourages women to submit their writing to top-tier journals. And there's some really cool stuff going on with us, too.
Lauren, it is a pleasure to have you on the program and to chat with you and get to know you today.
It's been really good to talk to you. Thanks so much for interviewing me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to be on here, and I hope now your first podcast experience is a good one here.
Yes, I have now initiated into podcast land.
And who knows where that will lead, you never know.
Yep. But tomorrow it'll be This American Life.
Hey, you never know, you know. Ira Glass, you never know when he'll be calling.
It's true.
But Lauren, you enjoy your holiday, enjoy it deeply, and you know, have a good time, and we look forward to hearing more stories from you. And of course, feel free to come back on the show anytime in the future.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend and happy Halloween.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.